Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the call over to Sara Fanta. Please go ahead.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining us today. We're going to be having our last call for the bone joint TAP, so we're very excited about that. I'm joined here today by Tarun Amin and Lorelei Dorian, and by phone, Ashley Wilbon and Sally Turbyville. So right now, we're going to begin our discussion of Measure 1603, submitted by NGenx. As you recall, it's their ETG hip fracture measure. Originally, it was submitted in conjunction with pelvic fracture. However, they took out the pelvic portion and just focused on hip fracture right now. So if Sherry or Tom want to begin and give a brief overview of the measure.
Yeah, this is Tom Lynn. This is a measure that captures the cost of care for hip fracture based on the episode treatment grouper methodology, which creates episodes of disease from administrative claims data. Once the episode is created, the administrative claims diagnostic data is used to gather severity markers and measure the severity of the hip fracture episode. That's my overview.
Okay, great. Thanks, Tom. Before we begin our discussion, I just wanted to do a brief roll call so your fellow TAP members know who's here right now, and just so it's on the record. So, Jim Weinstein?
Yes.
Okay, Mary Kay O'Neill?
Yes, I'm here.
Elizabeth Paxton? John Ratliff?
I'm here.
Okay. Catherine Roberts?
Here.
Craig Rubin?
Here.
Okay, and Patty?
Patsy, yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, thanks for that overview, Tom. I think that we're going to spend the majority of today, as I mentioned, just discussing basically the scientific acceptability. I know that the primary reviewers were Craig, Liz, and Catherine. I know that you probably haven't had a chance to discuss it since NGenx resubmitted their measure, but if you all feel comfortable and want to leave that part of the discussion, that would be great. And then I did email out the SurveyMonkey link. As we're discussing the measure, if you want to just go through and fill in your ratings, if you do have access to a computer. If not, if you all could send in those ratings by next Friday, that would be great. So we can go ahead and get started. It looks like, Craig, do you want to start off?
Sure.
2A1, and I'll pull it up on the slide.
So So
2A1 is that the measure is well-defined and precisely specified so that it can be implemented consistently across organizations?
Yeah, so just in general, this may not fit completely in the format, but hopefully I will touch upon the elements in the measure criteria. But as they point out, it's a very important problem, common problem. There's no question about the importance and growing importance that the cost of hip fractures and morbidity mortality, especially over the coming decades. My major comments or questions are with regard to the scientific validity and whether it captures, I think, some of the elements that are really, I think, critical to measure outcomes, especially comparing perhaps one site to another. The data is generated primarily from a young population, those less than 65. This steward points out that the problem of hip fractures is predominantly one of an aging population, and they very few instances of capturing the sort of the clinical picture of most of this patient population. So we can go over later in some of the details in terms of comorbidities, severity, complexities, but they don't match with the patient population. That is, that hip fractures increase in frequency, incidence, prevalence, predominantly in the age 70-75 group and higher, and most of their information comes from a younger group. And so they note that hip fractures will contain all clinically relevant information related to the condition, but I question whether that's true. And again, examples of condition status factors is diabetes and chronic bronchitis. There's a mismatch. You know, in the clinical evaluation of these patients, and I'll also defer to the orthopedic surgeons, but you know, the surgery is one issue, and I think hip fractures is a perfect clinical condition to be evaluated in that it's, you know, it's very clear-cut, you have a fracture, but the course and costs in terms of management and comparing quality after the repair include things such as delirium, typical postoperative complications, which they, I think, did address better in this. I didn't see previously pulmonary embolism or DVT. It is in one of their comorbidities, and now I can find it. But things such as delirium, you know, was not accounted for. When they assess severity of illness, and I'm sorry, I have to sort of click around here. You know, they use they do use age in a severity score, but you know they assign the same risk whether you're 65 or 90, and that it doesn't make any inherent sense. If I'm a provider of care and look at a cohort of people 65 to 70 with hip fracture compared to a population of 80. Plus, which is more likely to be the patient population you're going to be encountering, those risks are very different. So, you know, why are they assigned the same weight in the very discrepant populations with different risks and mortalities, morbidities? I would think if I'm a surgeon, I would much rather operate on the 65-year-old than the 85-year-old, the costs involved. And they appropriately allude to the importance of these measures in terms of accountable care organizations and the medical home, but in particular, this highlights the issues that these are system-based issues, and they do capture nursing home, rehab, and other costs involved in the care of these patients, but don't drill down to those important elements and comparisons and descriptions of patient populations that would be relevant to accountable care organizations and the medical home systems of care. So, you know, I'll stop here, but and answer any questions or let others weigh in. Hello.
Yes. This is Patsy, and I just have a couple of other questions. I'm again looking at the Excel spreadsheet, the reliability and validity. I see the comparisons are across healthcare organizations, across peer groups, and for cost and utilization. And this is kind of, you know, just a technical issue. The results across peer groups for cost and utilization seem to include pelvic fracture still. So it's a little hard to tell. Well, it's very hard to tell what you're comparing in the episodes. I haven't gone back and compared it to the other spreadsheet. But
can you tell me what section you're referring to? This is Sherry from NGenX, because we did alter all of our output results for the utilization factors to be just hip fracture resistance.
Okay, so I'm looking at the spreadsheet that's called Reliability Valid, and if you look at results across the first tab is reliability across HCOs. It calls it, for question essay answer in GenX, reliability, the measure is hip pelvic fracture. And then that's cost. So the HCO one still is called hip pelvic fracture, although it is now the ETG-based 713-103 hip fracture. The results are described in the tab reliability across HCOs. But if you look at results across peer groups, it includes pelvic fracture, the ETG group pelvic fracture 70328. And if you look at results across peer groups utilization, it also includes peer group pelvic fracture. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I see it. This is Tom Lynn. Oh, wait a minute. I'm on mute.
And then also the exclusion seems to describe hip pelvic fracture also, but we don't really know. So I would like to go, my guess is that's, you know, something that was missed in the, or maybe just a typo. But if we go back to reliability across HCOs, what I understand you describing is you run through the episode grouper, and define episodes separately for this condition, the hip fracture, for different healthcare organizations, and compare them on cost and utilization or episode numbers. Yes, visits. So it's cost and visits. So what are we to understand from these tables that, there's a lot of variation in the number of episode quantities. There's a lot of variation in the cost per episode, the primary care cost per episode. I mean, what are we supposed to infer from these tables as to reliability?
I think you're supposed to infer from these tables that, you know, the variability that you see here could be, is, you know, what you would expect amongst variabilities in healthcare organizations and is a relatively, a standard cost for the episode. We're trying to show, that's what we're trying to show here.
But we don't know whether running data from different organizations through the episode grouper is actually including and excluding. We don't know what the reliability of the grouper is from this, correct?
Well, I think it's a measure of reliability in that it's showing a relatively consistent cost across these healthcare organizations.
But we don't know that the cost, the relative consistency of the cost is due to the grouper function or the charge function. Although my recollection is a standardized cost. Is that correct?
I believe this data is generated on using standardized costs.
Mm-hmm. But again, we're back to the question of the episode grouper, which is the basis for all of this.
Correct.
We don't know that the grouper is reliable from these data, from these results.
Well, I think this data alone maybe doesn't show it, but I think that it does show that it's a relatively consistent cost across healthcare organizations. I don't know if I'm adequately answering your question.
No, I mean, you're answering it, but for example, I would want to know that, so I take the ETG grouper and I can change some of the criteria, for example, defining a low outlier, a high outlier based on cost or utilization. I might change the pharmacy inclusion or exclusion. I might change the duration of the episode or the absence of care algorithm. And then I would take one group of data or one HCO or all of them and change the criteria for the episode definition and the inclusion and exclusion definition. And I'd want to make sure that if I ended up with 1,000 episodes with the first definition of inclusion and exclusion, that if I let's say I change the high outlier from $50,000 to $25,000, I should know exactly how many episodes were excluded if I change that criteria.
Yeah, we have that information. Well, in that particular example, it wouldn't change the number that were excluded. It would change the dollars that were excluded. But we cap the high costs. We don't throw those out. But I hear what you're saying. We have that information about, you know, what's excluded. And we certainly could provide information for what would be excluded. The dollars that are excluded, because not cases, at different outlier thresholds, we could provide. We do exclude cases that are low in cost. We absolutely exclude them. We don't cap them or whatever the bottom part of that is. We do exclude them, so we could vary the low outlier and talk about the number of cases that are excluded by varying the low outlier. We have the data to do that. I guess you know that.
Okay. But it's not here in the report.
It's not.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so it sounds like we've pretty much covered 2A1, the measures well-defined and precisely specified, as well as 2A2, the reliability testing. So if anyone, if there's nothing else to add, we can move along to 2B1, that the measure specifications are consistent with the evidence presented to support the focus of measurement, and that the measure is specified to capture the most inclusive target population indicated by the evidence, and exclusions are supported by the evidence. It looks like that was also assigned to you, Craig?
Yes. Again, I'm coming from the, you know, clinician's perspective in terms of validity. 2B1, right? Talking about.
Yep, you're right.
Validity and.
Well, 2B1, yes, the specifications are consistent with the evidence presented.
Right, and again. The problem that I have is, you know, the evidence presented is, hasn't captured the patient population most likely to be affected by this problem. And no matter what numbers you generate, then how relevant they are, I question the validity.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just going to make a comment here as a measure developer. I don't mean to interrupt or speak out of turn. But, the fact of the matter is, you know, just to be fair and open, you guys probably already know this, that this rule was developed with commercial populations in mind. And, most of the data that we have here is commercial data, so we don't have a ton of Medicare data. So I have to say that that's true.
So then I understand that and sympathize with that, but then if you want to reconcile that with the issues of relevancy to, you know, broad populations, to the national healthcare issues in terms of this problem, the relevance and validity may be limited. It may not be any fault of the technique used, but the data may have limited broad applicability to those outside of the group studied, but those outside is the majority of the
right.
real world, not, you know, and what was studied was the minority. So that gets to the questions of validity and applicability. I don't know how to reconcile that.
This is Mary Kay, and you know, I'm thinking about what you're saying. In some ways, clinically, if you look at hip fractures in a younger population and an older population, they may actually represent quite different clinical situations, you know, other than major trauma. If a 40-year-old has a hip fracture, that's telling you something quite different than if a 70-year-old has a hip fracture. And so that incidence rates and utilization patterns and complications and comorbidities, even as people are getting to the older age of the commercial age cohort, may be more Medicare-like from a clinical situation. So it as a population measure, it may actually be kind of confusing different clinical entities and might be hard to tease out actionable items because we're really talking about very different clinical conditions in patient populations.
Right. I agree completely, and you articulated very effectively. But the reality is that the minority of, it's rare. It's rare for a 35 or, the example, getting 57-year-old to have a hip fracture unless, you know, it's in a traumatic fracture, a motor vehicle accident. But the world, in terms of the world of patients, the latter situation, the older patient, and as the developer points out, falls, is the typical factor, and that is the patient population that has the greatest relevancy for healthcare policy, for expenditures, and they are very different. And so if you're trying to capture costs or savings, it's hard to identify with the input or logic that was provided for the risk factors and so forth. It's going to be hard to tease out the origin of costs in different populations if those weren't even specified, the typical perioperative complications in the 80-year-old. That is the real world in terms of numbers, not the 57-year-old. So if anything, I sympathize with the challenge because the database mostly had younger patients. But the clinical problem, as demonstrated and put forth, that this is a serious problem, growing numbers, 10 times, this is the developer's numbers, I think 10 times higher risk of fracture in 80-year-olds. This is the largest growing segment of our population. And so, you know, I think the utility of this measure is going to be very limited because there just aren't that many hip fractures, in non-traumatic hip fractures in those, less than 65.
Well, this is John Ratliff, just chiming in and not to beat on this horse further, but for the relative risk assessment that you have and the severity score you proffer, the explication you give is quite good, but all of the measures that you use, by definition, are coming from a patient population of less than age 65, since the database you're using is, again, defined as like a non-elderly patient population. And then for each of these individual comorbidities, you're taking out the impact of their impact on patient outcomes to like 4 decimal places. Means you're pretty darn confident that what you're saying is accurate, and again, you're confident the measure is meaningful. I don't know how valid comorbidities in a 35-year-old are going to be in comparison to a 75-year-old. A 35-year-old with diabetes is going to be different than a 75-year-old with diabetes. Similarly with like COPD, I mean, it's a really different patient population, and I don't know if I get that bridge from the database that this is based on to the patients in the real world where we're going to be capturing capital outlay for hip fractures.
Okay, great. So it looks like we adequately covered 2B1, and we can move along to 2B2, which speaks to the validity testing, making sure that it's demonstrated across the measure data elements. It looks like Liz Paxton was assigned this, but I don't believe that she's here today. So if anyone wants to go ahead and jump in to begin that discussion, that would be great.
Just confirming, it's 2B1, right?
Right now we're on 2B2.
2B2.
Yes.
Well, I think we've talked about this.
Right. I think just in looking at the statistician's comments, if I may, in 2B2, item C is the data representative of the target population, ? And it cannot belabor the things. And then, another question, validity, is I'm not sure if there's a risk adjustment model for those in a different age group, 64 to 74, 75 to 84, and greater than 84. And the statistician comments whether this is adequately represented in the database. But my question I have is they're all assigned the same risk coefficients, whether you're 65 or 84, and I didn't understand how that just face validity is possible.
Do you want the developer to answer that question?
Yeah, I'd be happy.
I mean, you guys have pointed it out. I mean, it's the limitation of the data. We it's a commercial data set. There was a relatively small percentage, certainly not representative, of folks over 65 who, happen to be on commercial programs, or I think there's some like Medicare Part C folks that were managed by various health insurers, we didn't have enough patients to sort of stratify them further between from 65 and up, and it's a limitation of the data issue.
Right. So your findings were that the 85-year-old risk was the same as the 65 to 74 risk. I mean, that's what the data had.
Yeah, I wouldn't say those were our findings. They were.
Well, they all have the same value in the coefficients. Is that? I'm trying to find the right.
No, they do. They do have the same value because there's only one age range, and that's over 65.
But in one of the tables, you separate them out. You separate those age groups out, which I can't find. In risk factors, which table that was. But
it's F8.
Pardon?
I think it's F8, and there's a demographics tab on F8 hip fracture clinical logic. I'm not sure it's exactly set up the same way with you guys. I hope so.
Right, yeah, okay. So 85 is minus 0.89, and it's the same for all those age groups. And that's what you may have found. Is that right? Am I?
No. That's not right. That we were only, because of numbers, we were only able to really stratify based on 65 and above. And then we applied those to all those age ranges.
Okay. So it's unlikely, I don't have the data, but I'm fairly confident to say that the risk of a 85 and 65-year-old is not likely to be the same.
Right.
So, in terms of 2B2 is the data representative of the target population, and again, I don't want to necessarily belabor it, but I think, it just speaks to it again.
All right, great. So now we'll move along to 2B3, which are the exclusions are supported by the clinical evidence. Otherwise, they are supported by evidence of sufficient frequency of occurrence that the results are distorted with the exclusion.
That's me, but I don't really have anything else to add.
Anyone else? Then we can move along to 2B4,
which is resource use measures and other measures when indicated in evidence-based risk adjustment strategy is specified and is based on patient clinical factors that influence the measured outcome. So if anyone wants to begin discussing that, that would be great.
I wonder if the developer could talk a little bit more about the low dollar exclusion that you use for inclusion in the analysis per provider.
Yes. The that exclusion is based on group. Well, first we exclude some very low dollar amounts. But I think that's very low, like that's something that would be less than an office visit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take, we use the threshold for the bottom to be the bottom 2.5% of episodes. That's how we came up with that.
And is that per provider or per all episodes?
That's per, that's done by it's done over all episodes, but there's a separate one for severity and I think treatment indicator.
So you're saying, for example, I think you're saying that for all severity 1 hip fractures combined, you exclude the bottom 2.5% of episodes from further analysis.
That's correct.
You do not do it by individual provider type, but by individual provider, so that Dr. Jones gets the bottom 2.5% and Dr.
Nope.
Smith. Okay.
No, it's not by provider. It's we would calculate separate trim points for each peer group,
mm-hmm.
but not by provider. I think in this particular case, there's only one peer group, so it's not really an issue. But.
Mm-hmm. And what is the hypothesis there?
That we cut out the bottom 2.5%.
Mm-hmm.
The idea there is that you know that the bottom 2.5% are probably most likely to be mistakes or miscodes or things like that, and so they're eliminated.
Okay. So that they're probably incomplete.
Correct.
All right. If no one has any other questions about that section, we can move on to 2B5, which deals with the identification of statistically significant or practically or clinically meaningful differences in performance.
So I think this is Patsy again. I'm looking at S10_RAXLS, which is the risk adjustment method. It's a comparison of individual provider to peer group, right? And so you're looking at a relative cost of care ratio. Are there any other statistical tests that you recommend to define someone as different? Are you using a 5%, a 0.05 or a 0.10? Or?
We do recommend a statistical method. Sherry's going to have to help me whether it's described in detail here, because we do recommend that only statistically significant differences be reported or acted upon, or that the measurement be reported with a confidence interval. And we use a method that was described that's often used by RAND when they do these episode sorts of studies that measures the variance of the ratio.
Mm-hmm.
But we wouldn't say that just because it's 5% different that it's different. It depends on what the confidence interval is for that measurement.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that depends upon the underlying variance of the episode cost as well as the number of cases that you have.
Mm-hmm.
This is Tarun. I would also urge the committee to look at page 71 on the sample physician profile to see some of the output, to see if it's meaningful, clinically and statistically meaningful.
And so that's in the submission?
Yes.
So my pages, I'm sorry, so what's your page number again?
This is on page 71 of
okay.
the PDF for 1603, and it's also being projected on the screen, the webinar screen.
Okay.
So if we have no other comments, we can move along. We generally are skipping 2B6, which is the criterion that deals with multiple data sources. That's typically just been skipped. So we can move along to 2C, which discusses disparities in care. And it looks as though Catherine Roberts, would you like to begin leading the discussion?
Absolutely. Actually, I had no idea that was assigned to me. That must have found a different one. I have 3A, B, C, and 4 C and D, no?
Let's see. Oh, you're right. Actually, it should be Craig.
Yeah, so...
if you want to.
Address there's some disparities in incidence of hip fractures in different racial groups, but the numbers are very small. They can clarify, I think they are, age and sex are part of the risk adjustment models, but the numbers are very small in terms of different racial groups.
Okay, great. And if there's no other comments about scientific acceptability, that was the last criterion. Before you all go ahead and vote on the survey tool, if you want to use this time to ask any general questions to the developer about any issues with usability, feasibility, or importance, you can use this time right now. I don't know if anyone has any questions.
Hey, Sarah, this is Ashley. Maybe have them discuss the first three or maybe the middle two usability criteria just based on some of the discussion that came up with the applicability of the measure to the data that they had available. So 3B and 3C maybe.
Okay, we can do that. So 3B is that the measure performance results are considered meaningful, understandable, and useful for the intended audience for both public reporting and quality improvement. So I think I got this right this time, but I think, Catherine, that was your criterion?
Absolutely. And, I would like to first start and recognize Ingenix for their massive improvement in this measure in a very short period of time. So thank you to Ingenix. Of course, no measure is entirely perfect. I believe the only thing with usability preliminarily that we really wanted clarified was the data, whether that was, you know, both public and private, and I think they've pointed out that this is predominantly private data. The usability, at least specifically for 3B, Craig and I kind of rated as moderate. It's hard to be perfect, but within the limits of what they have, it seems adequate.
Okay. All right, great. So if there aren't any other comments about 3B, we can move along to 3C, which is that the data and result detail are maintained such that the resource use measure, including the clinical and construction logic for a defined unit of measurement, can be decomposed to facilitate transparency and understanding.
And again, sort of within the limits of what we've talked about and practicality, again, that's a moderate rating, at least for me and preliminarily from Craig, I believe.
Yeah, I agree with the effort and work put into this. There's no question about that. But in terms of having a measure and in endorsing something for the general public, it's going to have very limited, usability because the patient population is not what it was not the focus. And it's nobody's fault, but as I said, it is what it is. So I think the usability it will be very focused.
Okay, any other general usability or feasibility issues anyone wants to raise at this point?
This is Mary Kay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I have a new phone, and the mute thing is non-intuitive.
Okay.
So, I guess my concern, given the discussion about the age cohort for the database that NGenX has to work with, which is understood, and the natural history of this clinical condition, and the fact that what we might be doing clinically is reporting on mixes of patients in very different clinical situations and looking at utilization data by individual physicians or systems around really a mishmash of clinical settings, clinical storylines. So I'm always very hesitant to have measures go out there that appear to explain something they're not truly explaining. And so I would have some reservation about sort of blanketly applying this across a commercial population base without being clear that somebody, a young healthy person with a traumatic, sports or motor vehicle related fracture is not being really looked at the same way an osteoporotic older person is with their hip fracture. And maybe the risk adjustment manages that, but it's not clear to me that that's actually the case. So we might be sort of dumping what are essentially different diagnoses in the same bucket. I'm done.
Thank you. So in conclusion, Dr. Weinstein, I don't know if you have any comments that you want to make just overall about this measure.
Well, no, I didn't want to comment too much. I mean, I think the group has hit all the issues because the sample that was given or that the NGenX folks used it makes it hard to validate, as was discussed. And it's quite different to see a fracture in somebody less than 65 and somebody 80. I mean, the comorbidities, the survival rate, the treatment, I mean, just everything is different. I'm not sure how valid you'd want to suggest this measure is. And it's, on the other hand, the algorithms with the right population probably could work pretty well. So it's unfortunate. Maybe we should test this on a Medicare database, or if they wanted, we could probably do that for them or with them or however they want it. You know, we have those populations at Dartmouth. We do it all the time with the Dartmouth Atlas. So I hate to throw away the good work, but I certainly think that we should probably run this algorithm with a different population before I would want it to be going out to anybody as a hip fracture measure.
Now, we would, certainly love to have that sort of opportunity to work with you. We're
we're working with Medicare data right now that has the variation in age that, you know, that addresses the population that's.
We probably have years and years of data of hip fractures. It's a population we've studied a lot, and we have cohorts of populations. You know, we probably have several hundred thousand or a million hip fractures, you know, over 65. So we could even do segments by age, which would be interesting. So if you wanted to work with us on that, we'd be happy to be helpful. I've been talking to Sam Ho about some other work with you guys to try to help as well, but I leave that to you. But I would worry just from this exercise to support this without that kind of effort, because that's really the population that we need to study.
Can I just correct? Can I add one other point?
Go ahead, sir.
And again, it's, you know, a different day, but I would urge if there is an analysis done of a Medicare population, there are some very obvious comorbidities and complications that are not being addressed above and beyond age, and that is, you know, dementia, which is a risk factor for the hip fracture in the first place, but also recovery and other expenses, post-op delirium, you know, which doesn't appear here is a comorbidity or severity index score, you know, wound healing, urinary tract infections post-op, you know, all the clinical challenges once a person's out of the OR that are very common that should also be evaluated. Thanks.
This is Sally. I have a question for Jim, given your comment, as well as everybody on the panel. So I believe, and Tom, you can correct me, did you test this measure only in commercial data as presented to the TAP?
Yes.
Okay. So just as a reminder, that would mean this measure would be endorsed for the use in commercial populations only until you had the opportunity to come back with testing in Medicare, which I doubt there is sufficient time to do that under this project. So, you know, and to your point, Jim, absolutely, as you know, in general, for all measures, we're looking for the industry to move to testing it across more populations. So that said, Jim, what I'm interested, because your comment struck me, as to whether or not you would then consider this measure, if it were to be endorsed for implementation in commercial populations only, to then not meet the importance criteria, that is for the commercial population, because this type of medical occurrence, a hip fracture, is not sufficiently prevalent in the commercial population. So just wanted to probe your question a little bit further.
And Sally, this is Ashley, just to piggyback on that, and whether or not, I think this also touches in the usability criteria as well. So not only in the importance, but if your concerns about the applicability of this measure in the commercial population impacts the usability in such a way that the measure, it greatly limits the usability of the measure and how that might impact your recommendations for the measure, then obviously we'd be interested in hearing about your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah, well, as an orthopedic surgeon, you know, the number of hip fractures that we treat in people less than 65 is pretty small. And they're usually traumatic, very serious injuries, and have very significant ramifications, but it's a different animal. Maybe that's not the right word, but, I think everybody's, you know, Greg and everybody's highlighted that, and the issues are surrounding these patients. The hip fracture in itself is almost a lethal event. I mean, 30% mortality in 1 year after hip fracture. And then you throw in all the other issues with cognition and ambulation, and many of them actually, you know, become it becomes necessary to move out of their homes into assisted living facilities. I mean, it's a devastating event for most people. And the other thing, the epidemiology of these fractures is changing. We're starting to see this in older people, even as Greg alluded to, another decade older, which then creates even more problems because they're more serious and more difficult and there are more complicated fractures in these people. So I think it warrants an effort that, you know, again, we'd be happy to work with the group or and Genix to try to be helpful if that would be useful. But I understood what the questions were, and I'm not sure I could support it in a different population because I'm not sure how relevant it is.
Craig, I just wanted from the staff a clarification in criteria 1B in terms of importance to measure and report. It seems that a requirement is a demonstration of resource use or cost problems and opportunity for improvement. Goes on in the delivery of care across providers and or population groups. So I don't see that indicating that a subgroup, for example, commercial only, is appropriate. I thought by that definition, it should be appropriate across population groups.
It would. This is Tarun, by the way. It would be relevant for the population of focus within the measure. And since the measure is specified for use in the commercial population, really should be looked at in that context.
Thanks.
I guess for me, that's kind of a bait and switch.
Yeah.
I think of a hip fracture, and I don't think of like a commercially insured 45-year-old patient. I think I'm a 75-year-old. I think the measure of the foundation here is valid. This is an important public health issue. Yeah. Maybe the measure, the tool that we're studying isn't getting there. But still, I kind of answered the first one, A, B, and C, from a framework of thinking about grandpa with a hip fracture, not a commercially insured patient with a hip fracture.
This is Mary Kay again. And, you know, I guess what I'm trying to sort out in my mind is there's sort of like a clinical entity which might be called geriatric hip fracture, and then there's probably two other entities. One of them is trauma fracture in otherwise healthy people, and then there's, you know, those few cases for younger people with systemic diseases that give them osteoporosis or whatever, but which is too small to measure, I'm sure. But in a commercial population, a couple, you know, we're having a little bit of a demographic shift in the covered lives getting into older ages as people extend their work life timing. And so there is a subpopulation within the commercial database that is essentially behaving in the same way as Medicare folks because of their age group and, you know, what their medical condition is. So the problem for me in the commercial is that you're glomming three different clinical entities, probably primarily two, into the same measure and looking at utilization for very different clinical conditions. But we do in commercial have you know, it's not a bright line between commercial and Medicare. You know, some of our 58-year-olds are like that, and we've got some fully insured 72-year-olds because they're still working. So, but it's just to be able to accurately identify the clinical entity we're evaluating with the measure is probably the most important thing, and to get a critical mass of data would, as Jim pointed out, probably require the access to the Medicare data.
If there aren't any further comments, then I'll go ahead and ask Robbie if you could please open up the lines for public comment.
All lines are open.
If anyone listening in right now wants to make a comment, you can go ahead or ask a question. Okay, and it appears that we don't have any comments or questions at this time. So I just want to thank everyone for your thoughtful participation and your effort throughout this process. I know it's really time-consuming, but we definitely really appreciate all the work that you've put in. And I know that the Resource Use Steering Committee also really appreciates the detailed review of the measures.
Sarah?
Yes?
Exactly. Really quickly, just a last piece of guidance on as you submit your ratings for this measure. While I think the opportunity to test this measure in Medicare data would be great, particularly for this effort, but within the scope of this project and the timing, it wouldn't be possible at this point. So I would like for you guys to, as you're reading it, really think about the measure in the context as it was submitted, and be clear in your rationale in the spaces that were provided in the survey for why, you know, you've rated things as you have. That information will be really helpful for the steering committee as they review the measure and make any final recommendations. So it's evaluating the measure as is. So just wanted to put that out there.
And if you all could complete those evaluations by next Friday, COB, that would be really helpful on our end. So thank you to everyone, especially Dr. Weinstein, for chairing this TAP. I think he did a wonderful job, and I'm sure everyone would agree with that. So just as a reminder, the Cycle 1 report is going to be going up for comment on August 26th, dealing primarily with, like, the CV and diabetes measures. So feel free to leave comments on that report. And the steering committee will be discussing these measures during their August 30th and 31st in-person meeting. Are there any other questions before we adjourn?
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Great job, Sarah and Ashley and Lorelai and Tarun.
Thanks, Sally.
Good job, Sarah. Thanks a lot.
Oh, sure.
Right, talk to you guys later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
We're all good, Robbie?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. You have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.